This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. And it continues in Washington, but maybe some progress. Political science professors, Drake University's Dennis Goldford and the University of Iowa's Tim Hagel, will be commenting on the political implications of the federal government's fiscal glacier. Is there a thaw? And how much of a political hazard is it posing? And we're inviting your comments. Politics Day with political scientists Dennis Goldford and Tim Hagel. River to River, right after the NPR News. Dean Borg with River to River as we continue on Iowa Public Radio. The guests here this morning on Politics Day, and we're just past the noon hour, of course, Dennis Goldford, Drake University political science professor. Hello, Dennis.
Good afternoon, Tim, and good afternoon, Dean.
And as he said, Tim Hagel is here with me in our Iowa City studio. Dennis is in Des Moines. He's from Drake University. Tim Hagel, a UI political science professor, a regular on Politics Day. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Bring us up to date. This is a moving target.
It is, and it's funny that I'm almost a little worried that since I haven't looked at the news for the past 20 minutes, maybe things have changed again. No, it looks like that late this morning, the members of the Senate reached a deal. Senators Reid, Majority Leader Reid, and Minority Leader McConnell both came on the Senate floor and indicated that they had reached a deal. And basically, Reid was very complimentary about it, working with the Republican leader McConnell and so forth. McConnell was a little less happy, but was indicated that this was something that needed to be done. And the essence of the deal seems to be to extend the government till mid-January and extend the debt ceiling until early February with a few other details worked in. And so at this point, it's a matter of, okay, we'll get things up and running again. But what it does is it gives the leaders of both parties more time to try to work out something that's longer term.
You know, and there have been a lot of fits and starts. Up to, I would say, the beginning of this week, it was all one side or the other, and nobody was talking to each other. In fact, they weren't saying very nice things about each other. But on Monday, it started to thaw a little bit with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell each saying that they'd made tremendous progress. Now, listen to Harry Reid, the Democratic Majority Leader in the Senate, and listen now to the laudatory, listen to the change in rhetoric.
Mr. President, constructive good faith negotiations continue between the Republican leader and me. I'm very optimistic that we will reach an agreement that's reasonable in nature this week to reopen the government, pay the nation's bills, and begin long-term negotiations to put our country on sound fiscal footing. I deeply appreciate my friend, the minority leader, for his diligent efforts to come to an agreement. The Republican leader and I will keep members informed as negotiations continue.
Do you note the word friend, and then Senate Republican Minority Leader coming back, Mitch McConnell agreeing with Senator Reid?
Let me just echo the remarks of my good friend, the Majority Leader. We've had an opportunity over the last couple of days to have some very constructive exchanges of views about how to move forward. Those discussions continue, and I share his optimism that we're going to get a result that will be acceptable to both sides.
Dennis Goldford, what do you make of all that? It's like the Iowa weather. Wait 24 hours and things really change.
Well, you know, the Senate has always been a more collegial body than the House. There are 100 senators. There are 435 members of the House. Individual senators have more power due to the possibility of a filibuster, putting a hold on nominations and things like that. In the House, you're one of 435 people. There's a pretty rigid hierarchy in terms of power. So the Senate's always been more collegial, although in the past 20, 25 years, some of the kind of partisan bitterness that we find in the House and has increased over the years is leaking into the Senate somewhat. But still, in the Senate, nothing gets done unless you work together. The problem, of course, is that when you've got these sort of rancorous and toxic partisan divisions, how does the Senate get anything done? And the irony, of course, here is that the gridlock right now has been the House, because you have a weak speaker and an inability to control the Republican conference in the House. The Senate's taken the lead in terms of trying to keep the country from going over the default cliff. It's a particular risky gamble on the part of Minority Leader McConnell, because he's up for re-election in 2014 and faces not only a Democratic challenger but a Tea Party challenger himself.
Dennis, you mentioned House Speaker John Boehner, and we have a cut from him, too. After he failed in the House, this was yesterday, failed in the House to come up with the necessary votes to pass a counterproposal and send it over to the Senate.
There are a lot of opinions about what direction to go. There have been no decisions about what exactly we will do. But we're going to continue to work with our members on both sides of the aisle to try to make sure that there's no issue of default, and to get our government reopened.
Tim Hagel, what do you hear John Boehner saying there?
Well, he's certainly not a happy camper at that point. But the thing that's interesting about that is, in looking at the last couple of cuts you played, where initially on Monday you had Reid being very friendly in his language to, in conciliatory his language to Mitch McConnell, and then after the failure of the House to kind of come together on some sort of compromise, that then Harry Reid's rhetoric ramped up again. And so it's very volatile, and it sort of gets to Dennis's point about the sort of the idea that the Senate is supposed to be more collegial. And that's one of the things that surprised me over the last few debates, not just this current one with the with the debt ceiling, but with the shutdown and some of the other stuff, where sometimes the language coming out of the Senate is just, is well, not very collegial, to put it as an understatement. And I think that that kind of hurts the process in ways that you don't see from the House, since the House does tend to be a little bit more feisty in both their rhetoric and the politics that they play.
We have had some pretty nasty things, you're right, Tim, coming between Reid and McConnell not too long ago. So it does tend to blow back and forth. But I think the difficulty in the House is that the Republicans operate under a self-imposed rule they call the Hastert Rule, named for former Speaker Denny Hastert from Illinois on the Republican side. And that is, they will not bring a bill to the floor of the House that doesn't have a majority support or a support of a majority of the Republicans. What that does is give particular factional groups within the party, the Republican Party, the ability to block bringing a bill to the floor. Everybody argues or agrees that if they put this sort of bill on the floor of the House, the Democrats and enough Republicans would vote for it that it would pass. But these various groups within the Republican Party opposed to various things in the bills or the proposed bills, they're able to block that bill from coming forward, and that's been the difficulty.
So how then, assuming now that something has to originate in the House and this compromise— It has in the House, isn't it right, Tim?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How can they do that, Dennis, originate in the House and still bring it to a vote? Because ostensibly, the more conservative majority of the Republicans who, under the Hastert Rule, would prevent that from being brought up under the Hastert Rule, how can that happen?
Well, that's the interesting question. There are certain kinds of procedural, arcane procedural rules they can use. I mean, you know, any traditionally spending bills originate in the House, but that's just tradition. Taxing bills are the ones that have to originate in the House. These are spending bills, so that it's the tradition that they originate in the House, but I don't believe it's constitutionally required. I think that at times, you know, the Senate might write a bill and claim that in some degree or some way they're simply revising something they had at some earlier point from the House. So they make the rather weak claim that it did originate in the House. But I believe since this would be a spending bill, it's not constitutionally required to originate in the House.
One thing on that, and maybe some of the listeners can do a quick lookup of the Constitution. I know it's Article 1, Section 7, but I can't remember the specific term that's used. I think it's revenue. And then, of course, it's, well, does that mean taxing or does that include spending? And that's sort of an open question. That's really not the problem here in terms of it's originating in the House. The problem is more back to what Dennis was saying about the Hastert rule, which isn't an official rule. And the idea is simple, that you do want to make sure, for the most part, that a majority of your coalition, whether it's in this case Republicans, but I suppose Democrats would, you know, want to do something similar, that in order to keep your caucus together, that you would want to make sure that at least a majority of them are going to support whatever it is that you're putting forward. In this particular instance, it may very well be that the Hastert rule is going to be violated, but I think that in large measure, that may not be as much of a problem for Boehner as you might think, simply because there may be many House Republicans who are happy to find some solution to this problem, even if they aren't necessarily going to vote for it. And if you get enough Republicans that will join a sufficient number of Democrats to pass it out of the House and move it on to the Senate, that then the House Republicans who still vote against it will then be safe in the sense that they can still say that they adhere to principle. They're less likely to get a challenge from the right come primary time. And basically, it still is a way out of the problem.
I'm going to turn that back to you, Dennis, in just a minute. And that is, I'm going to be asking you, is Speaker Boehner falling on his sword in any way to preserve the nation's credit rating? That is, this, ostensibly, from what we've heard up to now, is not going to be popular, any sort of a compromise. In fact, 4th District Congressman from Iowa, Steve King, in the last 24 hours saying, hey, we've come so far, we're just about at the finish line, don't give up now, don't compromise now. But I wanted to, you invited the listeners in, and I want to reemphasize that. Dial 1-866-780-9100. It's 1-866-780-9100. Or reach us on river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org or on Twitter at IPRTalk. Again, the number is 866-780-9100. Dennis?
Well, that remains to be seen what will happen with John Boehner. He has been, as I said, a weak speaker by the nature of this fractious Republican caucus and the weakness of political parties, which leaves members more reliant upon outside funding groups than the party itself. It's hard to enforce any sort of party discipline. There was an attempt to vote against Boehner as a speaker a while ago, and it failed. But, you know, the Tea Party caucus in the House among the Republican conference, among the total number of Republican members, is not a majority, although it's a pretty good chunk. But, you know, that's an open question, I think, is about whether he's falling on his sword. He may be so irritated with some of these people. He may say, the heck with it. I'm going to do what I think is good for the party and the country and come what may. So we don't know yet. That remains to be seen.
Yep. Yeah, it's not entirely clear that there's anybody in the House, at least, that's willing to challenge him at this point. And you're never quite sure of the behind-the-scenes sorts of things, but Eric Cantor seems to have been sort of, if not in lockstep, at least fairly well along for the ride with Boehner to try to find a solution of some sort to this. So I can't see that anybody else in the House, at least, would be willing to step up. Of course, on the other side, you've got Senator Ted Cruz, but you know he obviously can't decide what goes on in the House.
I've got a caller here. I don't have a name, but I'm putting you on the air. Go ahead. Nope, can't. And I've got another one here, and this is Dan on the road. Dan, you wanted to comment.
Well, I just wanted to say I live in Iowa. Steve King is my representative, and I'm just kind of ashamed to say that he is my representative.
And thanks for your call. I know that you're on the road, and I appreciate that comment. If you'll listen right after the break, we are going to talk about the implications for Tom Latham, Bruce Braley, perhaps, and Steve King as well. So, Dan, stay with us, and we'll be talking about that. Thanks for your call.
All right. Thank you.
Tim, I'm going to go back and about the implications for Speaker Boehner. About him falling on his sword, who might replace him? There's nobody else to replace him there, is there, in the House?
Well, that's what I was saying, is that the would seem like maybe somebody else in leadership, whether it would be Boehner or Paul Ryan or Kevin McCarthy, that one of those folks who seem to have been, you know, integral and part of this process, but they've been pretty much working with Boehner as opposed to in opposition to him, or at least they apparently, you know, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but they haven't been willing to step up and basically undercut whatever it is that Boehner's doing. Now, we may see something, and I think Dennis is right that at a certain point, as a speaker with such a tough job, you may just say, okay, it's time for me to move on and let somebody else have the headaches.
Tim, do you recall when there was that vote for Boehner as Speaker and some people opposed it, was it simply a no vote or didn't they vote for somebody else in the House? But I can't recall who that might have been.
I can't recall either. I think there was some talk of Eric Cantor being the one that was supported by a few people, but I think at a certain point he backed out and said, no, I don't want to take that.
Gentlemen, we're going to be back talking more about this, and I've already said we're going to be talking about the implications on Iowa's caucuses and Iowa's congressional delegation. And we'll be back in just a few minutes on River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Continuing River to River now on Iowa Public Radio. And Tim, before we went to the break here, we were talking about the constitutional requirements for bills like this to originate in the House and whether that might put a burden on Speaker Boehner in trying to rally the majority Republicans in the House when they are so deeply divided. And we have Sarah. You asked anyone who had reference to the Constitution to call in, and Sarah did. And she says that Article 1, Section 7 says all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments, as in other bills.
Right. And so we're back to what I was thinking before, is that what exactly does it mean by revenue? Is that just taxes? Does that include spending? And really, in essence, it's kind of a minor point, as Dennis was sort of suggesting earlier. We have a certain constitutional requirement, but even aside from that, that there's sort of a tradition that these types of bills start in the House. And regardless of what the particular procedural method is that's going to be used, they're still going to be able to get this thing through. And the more important point is the deal that they have decided to put together to move from the House to the Senate.
Dennis, just a few minutes ago, Bruce Braley, we were talking about the possible implications for Iowa's congressional delegation. We have a piece of tape here that has been prepared for us just in the last few minutes. Democratic Congressman, 1st District, Bruce Braley, of course, who is running to replace Senator Tom Harkin in the Senate, just a few minutes ago on a conference call, was asked what he would say to voters who are suggesting that all incumbents, a plague on all your houses, need to be voted out because of the partial government shutdown, the impasse, and the near default. But he's touting his own bipartisan leadership.
You know, I think that what I would say to them is, you want people in Congress who have a proven history and track record of bringing Republicans and Democrats together to solve tough problems. I've done that in the past. When I was serving in the minority in the House, I was able to get bills that I introduced passed into law with Republican support. Every bill that I've introduced that's become law has been with Republican support, some of them to help keep jobs in Iowa for Iowa businesses. So if that isn't something that people value, then I would just ask them to think about what it would be like if we bring even more polarized people to Washington. I think what people want is people who've had the life experience I have growing up in a small town in Iowa where party labels meant less than what you do to help me solve the problems in my community. That's what I think we need more of in Congress, and I think that's what I offer.
Dennis, it's your business to read between the lines. That's who you are as a Drake University political science professor. So, number one, are voters paying attention and assessing blame? And is what Bruce Braley and a lot of others, because that's the same thing a lot of others are saying, I am bipartisan, it's my colleagues here who can't get along, is it going to sell?
Well, Brantley certainly hopes it will sell, as do all incumbents. First of all, let's be clear. Despite the fact that we always have trouble in the Senate with regard to the filibuster and needing 60 votes for a particular measure to overcome threats of filibuster and shut off debate, this particular crisis was brought about by the House of Representatives. It was not the Senate. Number one. Number two, Brantley and all incumbents will want to say, at least other than Tea Party incumbents who basically want to plant their flag, take their stand, and go down in flames if they believe they need so to do so. It reminds you of the Goldwater phrase, in your heart, you know he's right. That's where a lot of the Tea Parties are. I've heard some Tea Party types talk about Republicrats. In other words, they don't see any difference between Democrats and what they call the Republican elites or Republican establishment. But that being said, Brantley is going to say, look, it's not my fault. I try to be bipartisan. I think when push comes to shove, Republicans want a Republican plan to the exclusion of the Democrats. Democrats want a Democratic plan to the exclusion of Republicans. It tends to be more independents who talk about bipartisanship. But there is a sense out in the public right now of a plague on both your houses, and incumbents are worried about that.
Two quick points to follow up on that. As far as the Brantley side of things, yeah, that by and large incumbents are going to try to say, well, look, I tried to work this out. I tried to find a deal. Republicans will, of course, come back on Brantley's comment saying, no, this fellow is to the left of even Tom Harkin. And of course, for Harkin supporters, that's a good thing. So we'll have to see how that flies with independents. I have to take issue, though, with the notion that it's totally on the House – at the House's fault that the shutdown occurred and we had this sort of crisis with the debt ceiling, because at least as far as the shutdown is concerned and even with some of this other stuff, that the House was passing, and you know, you can argue, as many Republicans do, with the strategy of the House Republicans in terms of how they approach this. But even after the initial strategy failed, they did pass a number of bills that were trying to compromise, find some sort of compromise, and it was the Senate that held fast. Now, you can say, good, they held fast, they stood up for principle, and that's usually a good thing. But on the, from the other side, you can say, well, also they weren't trying to compromise. And so it took two houses to make this shutdown and to make this crisis.
Do you want a response?
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think certainly on the Senate side, you've got people insisting on various elements of their perspectives. But really, I think there is a certain measure of holding the debt ceiling hostage. And I think while that was suggested by and supported by Senator Cruz and Senator Lee, Cruz from Texas, Lee from Utah, it's the House that had the particular power in that regard, and the inability of the House Republican conference to find some minority view that didn't demand some sort of concession on Obamacare, or else we're going to, you know, risk throwing the U.S. into default. And so I think, you know, we can argue that, yeah, there is to some extent. I think you're right, Tim. I think there's some response on the Democratic, on both the Democratic and Republican sides in the Senate, some responsibility there as well. But I think in this particular case, maybe because of the weakness of Speaker Boehner and the factions among the Republican conference in the House, I think I would put at least more weight on the responsibility on the House.
Let me go back to something you just said. You said the weakness of Speaker Boehner, and you're not alone in saying that. I think that's generally what I have heard in many, many commentaries. But do you think, Tim, and I'll ask you too, Dennis, to defend it, that he is really weak, or is he just between a rock and a hard place?
It's probably some combination of the two, that if you have a really strong speaker of one sort or another, that then all of a sudden that person gets criticized for ruling with an iron fist or something of that nature. And as Dennis was pointing out earlier, that the parties are not as influential as they used to be because members have to look to outside groups to raise money and so forth. And so it's more difficult. And certainly this is also a time for when the Republican Party is split a little bit more. Given, and I know people heap all kinds of criticism upon the Tea Party, but the point is that they were elected to serve a particular function, to come in and look for efficiencies, reduce spending, reduce the size of government. And so that that's one of the things that they have to account for to their constituencies. And so that makes it difficult for Boehner then, who has to deal with the folks that have this as their main goal versus the folks that may not have that as a main goal.
You know, you spoke of raising money. Dennis, I said I was let you defend it. Do you have anything more to add?
Well, yeah, just real quickly. I would say that, you know, Newt Gingrich is a strong speaker. Whether you agree or disagree with what he happened to do, he was a strong speaker. But that was 15 going on almost 20 years ago. And we do have, as Tim correctly said, all these outside groups now, both in terms of outside media and outside funding groups and interest groups and lobbying groups, not the traditional ones, but, you know, the think tanks and so forth. And when I say Boehner's a weak speaker, that may be somewhat unfair to him because, Dean, I think he may be more between a rock and a hard place. You just can't discipline members as well anymore when they are looking more and more to these outside groups for their financial and campaign support, and the party itself doesn't have the ability to discipline them.
Interesting that you said that because over the weekend, maybe both of you saw this, two former congressmen, Democrat Neil Smith and Republican Jim Leach, appearing on the Iowa Press program, both blamed money, specifically the high cost and virtually unlimited influence by big money contributors for congressional ineffectiveness now. Is there any indication that voters are so fed up, you think, with incumbents that newcomers or third parties might benefit, Tim?
Well, certainly newcomers, you know, if you get that we're throw the bums out kind of an attitude, regardless of party, that newcomers come in fresh face. And we often have that sort of situation where somebody says, well, I'm not of Washington, you know, send me there. I'll be a citizen.
Let me just add to that. Both sides, everybody who has any interest in raising money is using this impasse to try to raise money. I can't count the number of emails that I have received. In fact, just one this morning, a 32-page email from Congressman Ron Paul, and it says, Patriot, if your teenage son or daughter maxed out their credit cards, would you give them money to increase their credit limit? Then why should the American people let Congress increase the Treasury Department's credit limit? Raising the debt ceiling, underlined now, is not necessary for the government to pay its bills. And, of course, this goes on, but there's a fundraising appeal back here in the back page. Cut up Washington's credit card. Click here.
Sure. And you mentioned that it was former Congressman Ron Paul that sent that out, but other Republicans and various Democratic groups do the same thing and do this on a regular basis. And it always strikes me as a little unseemly to be fundraising off of some of these things. And occasionally you'll get a little bit of backlash in the news over it. But that's the kind of a thing that clearly it works, because you get a time when you have some major issue in the news, whatever it happens to be. And if you can somehow heap blame on the other side, get your base energized in some particular way, then it gives them an opportunity then to say, yes, I'm tired of this. I'll send you, you know, $5, $10 or whatever it happens to be.
Right. I promised that we were going to get into the implications for two congressmen. We've heard Bruce Braley. Republican Tom Latham raised nearly $500,000 this past quarter for his 2014 reelection campaign, while the Democratic challenger Stacey Apple raised about $239. And I'm wondering about that race, because Latham has just moved into a new district, just took over that seat, that congressional seat, from an incumbent Democrat, Leonard Boswell. And here's what Apple says. I don't know what happened there, but what he said is, I don't think Iowans are up for gambling with the full faith and credit of the United States. And then let's go then to another cut. And apparently we can't, because the same thing is going to happen. But out in the 4th District with their U.S. Representative Steve King, the incumbent there, and apparently very comfortable, he feels, Democratic challenger Jim Maurer outraised Steve King, Republican from Chiron, Maurer raising $181,000 in the quarter through September 30th, King raising $109,000, and there... The Federal Election Commission, Maurer saying, Congressman King and a small number of his Tea Party colleagues are holding the U.S. government hostage, and that's having a great impact on our economy and the American people. That's the cut that we would have played had we been able to. But what do you make of all of that, Dennis?
Well, I think that as we look at these guys, certainly, I mean, everybody's looking forward to, well, not looking forward with glee, but looking forward to planning for the next election. And I think that Tom Latham is in a somewhat more heterogeneous district than Steve King. He covers Polk County, some of the most urban areas in the state, and some rural areas as well. There's a slight Republican plurality in the 3rd district. But the 4th district, Steve King's district, is extremely Republican. I mean, it's got a plurality of Republicans in terms of the most recent registration, but slightly behind that is no party or independents. But most independents in the country tend to lean towards the Democrats or the Republicans. There are relatively few pure independents. Maybe 9 or 10% of the population nationwide would be pure independents. But King is in a pretty solidly Republican district. Now, what's most interesting is the fact that, and I think you noted it in an email, that Business Week reports that some pro-business Republicans are looking toward finding a candidate to challenge Steve King in the primary.
Somebody who would be more moderate, you're suggesting.
Right, or at least more business-oriented, because a lot of the Tea Party people are suspicious of big business and corporate America as well. It's part of the Republican factionalism right now. So we've seen that, but even for moderate Republicans, their concern is about being Tea Party in a primary, having a stronger challenger to the right. That's how Mike Lee got in, replacing former Senator Bennett, who was everybody's standard conservative out in Utah a few years ago. So, you know, the more homogeneous the district, the more one party they are, the less you have to fear from somebody in the other party, the more you have to fear from somebody in your own party in a primary.
And I'll get to you in just a minute, Tim, but I want to give our number here one more time in case people want to tell us whether or not they're going to be taking recent events into account come election time. The number to call is 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100 or river2river at iowapublicradio.org on Twitter at IPR Talk. Tim?
Looking, I guess, at the 4th District, I think it would be very difficult for any pro-business moderate to successfully challenge Steve King in a primary. It's because of the number of Republicans, registered Republicans in that district, and the fact that they tend to be more conservative. And as Dennis was saying, that the Tea Party folks, although Tea Party and social conservative is not a complete grouping of the two, correspondence between the two, but still I think that it would be very difficult for them to get behind somebody that's more moderate, successfully more moderate in the sense that they were challenging Steve King. Now, if Steve King were to step down or run for another office and then had some pro-business moderate run, that person might win in a primary and depending on who else was running. But I think to challenge Steve King, I don't see that happening. Of course, we're still a long ways out. The Latham district in the 3rd district, that's a little more interesting. Again, it is the Republicans don't have the same voter registration advantage over Democrats as in the 4th district. But still, it's I think that it would be very difficult to unseat him, of course, as the cut that you wanted to play indicated, that certainly Democrats are going to tie this, and they have hammered and hammered and hammered on the notion that it's the Tea Party Republicans. Now, Latham isn't necessarily associated with the Tea Party to the same extent Steve King is, but that's not going to stop his opponents from trying to make that connection.
Latham's very close to Speaker Boehner, so you know, like the Democrats might well try to tie Speaker Boehner to Tom Latham.
I've got to bring one of our callers here on the line. Stephen, you go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment was I recently learned that there was a rule passed in the House, Rule 386, I believe it is, that changed the function of bringing a bill to the floor so that only the Speaker, only the majority leader, has the right to do so. That rule is kind of a large part of where this deadlock came from, and I'm just wondering your acquaintance's feelings on how we could possibly get rid of that and whether or not they think it was as big of an issue as I do.
Thank you, Stephen, for the call.
No problem.
I'm not overly familiar with that procedure in terms of some of the arcane aspects of how things get to the floor. It wouldn't surprise me if whatever party happened to be in the majority does things that basically gives them a little bit more control. I don't know. Dennis, do you know anything more about it?
Well, he may be referring to the Hastert rule, but remember that the speaker is the speaker because he commands the support, or she, as the case of Nancy Pelosi a few years ago, commands the support of the majority party. And one of the changes in committee structure was to make the House Rules Committee much more under the control of the speaker. The House Rules Committee is a very small committee, very arcane, but it determines what bills come to the floor, under what conditions, how they'll be debated, and that's very much a committee controlled by the leadership, and that's whichever party is in the majority.
I have a call from John in Cedar Rapids, and I think I'm going to. He's asking how long will the Tea Party have control in the House?
Well, I think it's an open question as to how much control they have now. That certainly you have a group of members of the House that associate themselves with the Tea Party or the Tea Party Caucus. And that's an important group for making sure that, you know, if you're going to pass something, you have to have those folks on board. And so in that sense, they are important.
But the whole House is elected every 2 years.
The whole House is elected every 2 years. And to whatever extent that Democrats in particular and even some Republicans can criticize the Tea Party and suggest that those folks shouldn't be in Congress, that they held hostage. I always detest the hostage language, but it's there. That maybe that will add strength to their opponents, either in terms of any kind of primaries against these Republicans or for general election purposes.
And thanks for that question, John, from Cedar Rapids. Tom's on the line from Fort Dodge. Tom?
Yes. I'm calling about the election process that is controlled by the Republican and the Democratic parties. It isn't a matter of term limits. I believe that's the fundamental cure for it, but we have a situation to where the parties actually own our government instead of representing us. I would expect that most people would be surprised if a person campaigning for a seat and was elected, having taken X amount of dollars from a special interest group, regardless of what that group is, that they would represent us who have not donated, at least in any substantive.
Tom, I think we have your question. Tim has a puzzled look on his face here.
Oh, he does? Yes. It shouldn't be puzzling at all for him.
All right.
The reality is that we are not represented.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
No, it wasn't so much puzzled. It was more of a concentrating on the call. I always want to make sure I can get whatever's being said. This gets back to the question of the importance of money and so forth. And, you know, obviously, because money is so important, has to be raised in such quantities that does divert, shall we say, the candidate's attention perhaps from the people, as it were. But on the other hand, they also have to make sure that they get those votes.
Dennis, just in the 1 minute that we have, and in fact less than that, is the split state of the Republican Party going to at all be a factor in the next election, do you think?
I'm not sure so much about the congressional elections for the House and the Senate. I think more significant is what it might foretell about the next presidential election.
Well, thanks to both of you. With Dennis Goldfridge, Drake University political professor, Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa Political Science. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Statton. Catherine Perkins, our executive producer. We had assistance today from Dennis Reese in Iowa City, John Pemble in Des Moines. I'm Dean Borg, and River to River is produced by Iowa Public Radio.